God at the movies. It is the general idea that God is at work everywhere. If you have eyes to see and ears to hear, you can hear not just God speaking, but also the cries of humanity, the questions people have, the stories that are resonating in culture and in societies. Engage with what it is that the media, the movies, the TV shows, critically think through them, and not in a way where you're like critiquing them all the time, but in a way where you're engaging with them in a meaningful way. What is it about this that resonates with you? What's true about it? What's false about it? What are the claims of this that are not true? What are the things that are happening? We shouldn't turn our brain off. We shouldn't turn our spirit off. We shouldn't turn God off, ever. How do we begin to attune to stories that move us, why they move us, how we see God at work in the world? So this is a series kind of along those lines.
All right, friends, welcome back to what is this podcast called?
God of the Movies? Is it God of the Movies?
Oh, Right Side Up. Right
Side Up. Oh, sorry.
James Scholl.
And Danielle Strickland.
And special guest today, Cheryl Nemhard.
Hooray!
Hey! Yes.
And this podcast season is God at the Movies / TV show / media / whatever. We can't really find a catchy term.
Mainly visual media. That's the, yeah.
Visual God at the, oh, we were going to say like God on my couch, pass me the popcorn.
We have the worst names for our podcast. That's really the.
But the topics and the subject matter and the guests are second to none. So,
oh, that's absolutely, yeah. Once you get through that first 45 seconds, it's solid gold, folks. Yes.
And we probably shouldn't say this, but all of the people on this podcast right now are not, would not say that they were morning people. We are so committed to each other that we chose to wake up in the morning and record at the worst time for both of all of us. And here we are. So hopefully this is going to make some sense, guys.
I get one day off a week and I set an alarm.
It's all for you guys. All for you.
And the reason why, of course, is because we are talking about the woman king.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the most remarkable and interesting and controversial movies of the
year. Cool? Was it not so cool? Sorry, like, I mean, it was awesome.
It was amazing. I saw it four times. It was nuts. Something really, really big.
One of those times we saw together.
Yeah, and so it was transformative.
Like a two-hour podcast afterwards in the car that we didn't record. But we should have because it was intense.
Right.
So let's, let us begin. The Woman King. What, I should mention that when we did the Best Picture, run through the first couple episodes of this podcast, we did mention that The Woman King was left out, was maybe one of the greatest sort of, snubs in the history of film.
It
definitely for Viola Davis, who has always outspoken about this already and has mentioned that this has been her whole life. Because I think it was one of the best performances I've ever seen. She was phenomenal.
Absolutely.
I mean, she's a phenomenal actress, but I just thought that had got to make the list of at least performances, but the Oscars snubbed her as usual. So I did mention that. So if you listen to that and you were like, yeah, I want to know more about that, well, welcome. On The Woman King.
Love it.
Okay, Cheryl, give us your big, what is this movie? How does it reflect our culture at the moment?
Oh, man. First of all, can I just say that something really deeply, profoundly impacting happened in my life when I was watching that movie. I did not expect it. It came out of nowhere. But I, and this sounds so cliche, but I saw myself on the screen in so many ways. And that hit some nerves. It brought up some things. I think right off the top, there's this incredible pride of the people. There's this overwhelming sense of like, we live in this beautiful, sacred place that needs to be protected, that we need to do something to ensure the life of it. And they're desperately looking for solutions. And in that desperation, I guess the kings before made a decision that didn't sit well with some of the people, particularly Maniska, our main person. I hope I said that. Yes, Maniska, who's struggling internally with the idea of selling her own people. And that's not the way. She really feels like there is another way through palm oil, through agriculture, through other things. So that's stirring within us and really speaks to the whole idea that historically that nobody, you know, wants to touch on is that part of slavery, a huge part of slavery, is that we were sold out. We were betrayed by our own, mm-hmm. you know. Feels very Judas, feels very, that betrayal by our own people. And then I love the idea that...
Okay, wait, just pause here for a second.
I know, because that's big, right? Yeah.
Let's give us a moment.
And then also, because that was the controversy of the film, was people were, okay, first of all, the critique was that it was historically inaccurate, which is like, I don't know how that's a critique that's not applied to every single nod to history film. Like, I've never seen a historical film that was like, yes, that is exactly what happened. Like,
it's not claiming to be a documentary, is it?
Right. So one, it's like, it's historically inaccurate. So people were like, and then two, I guess that specific tribe is more responsible. And the oldest and the legacy of that tribe is the slave trade in Africa.
Yes.
So they were the prominent, you know, so I had some Nigerian friends living with me when the movie came out, and they were like, it's not just that, like, part of the controversy is that it's not just they just took a tribe that was a bit complicit. They took the tribe.
That's right.
It was the most complicit, and they kind of bent it a bit to suit their purposes. So at the same time, this movie was so controversial and being boycotted, the queen died. I don't know if you remember this.
That's right.
The queen died. And when the queen died, there was a fair bit of mixed feedback. But most of the people, particularly, this is good you're here, James, from the UK.
Yeah, thanks. Representing all 60 million of them. That's
or just the queen.
Yeah, just her, actually.
And everybody was sort of like, I pushed back and said, I don't know how we celebrate the colonial impact around the world of slavery and of poverty and of war and all kinds of things that are directly linked to this power. And then everyone was like, yes, but she was a good Christian woman. And which I also think she probably was. I think she was a good Christian woman. But they were very willing to, I guess what I'm saying is it was super easy and they were super willing to hold the tension and the complexity of her living in a situation where that kind of power was like destructive, but also at the same time, she was doing the best she could in the circumstances that she was born into.
Yeah.
And then my critique was, so you can hold this for her without thinking that's a problem, without, you know, worrying that you're being complicit in some sort of like cultural pain or ongoing systemic issues, but you cannot hold it for a tribe in Africa who has that same complicit background, who has that same, not exactly the same, but like exists because of the colonial power of this woman's background, but also who have that same complicit reality. Like, this is the easiest way for us to get money and prestige and power. So this is what we're going to do. And then the complexities within that. So I just thought it was really interesting that we had all the room and space in the world to celebrate the goodness of the queen and the complexity of her heritage. And we had zero for the complexities of an African tribe trying to navigate through slavery.
Yeah. I think that's so big. And, you know, not to hit it where it hurts, but it just goes to show you what we will forgive when we put sacredness and majesty on something. Mm. Like, and it feels very much like our present day struggles. The unforgivable sins, I mean, on a much lower level, that we are willing to blindly ignore because of the veil of sacredness and majesty. And I know that Queen Elizabeth was a wonderful person, and she tried to redeem the atrocities of her lineage. But at the end of the day, the wealth is bought in blood, you know, like colonialism has just ravished and just ransacked nations and robbed people of lives and wealth. And so, yeah, but it's interesting when you can put traditions and formality. And like, I think about all the things that the monarchy is and why people hold it so dear and will refuse to listen to anything else about the darker side of monarchy because of how we present the sacredness of it.
Wow.
Ain't that like the church, y'all?
Like, I know there's nothing analogous about this conversation. I think what's interesting there, Cheryl, as well, you said one of the things that evokes such a painful response from you, I suppose, was that kind of, reminder of some of the way that tribes were complicit. This is not, of course, to abdicate responsibility from the people that, like, really profited from it, but of course, even the criticism of this movie is like, well, the Dharma Nation were actually more responsible for this. It's like, yeah, that's just painful though, right? That so many people, like, as you say, this kind of Judas feeling that, like, yeah, you're right. Because, hey, you know what? It turns out that, like, power and wealth corrupt people. Like, hey, who knew? Like, that love of money will be the root of all evil, regardless of the...
Who knew? Yeah, right. Yeah, so there's that, the whole colonialism and the slavery piece is so painful and so profound, but there's some incredible themes that I thought would be great to talk about, which I think are the other beautiful sides. I'm always reflecting back to the Big C Church and just like where we are at, you know, at as a people and faith and all the things. But here we have a king who actually raises, like, let's talk about that for a minute. Raises an all-female army, like his highest royal guards, all female. Like, what a incredibly bold, unorthodox move. And they are feared in the land. He puts all of his faith and trust in them to protect all that he holds dear. And I just love that piece of female empowerment to me. It's just like incredible. Yeah.
I think one of the things about this movie that I really respected, and I think why it was hard to receive, is the way that they leaned into the tension in all the areas. So back to that other conversation, I just want to say it's the sacredness of what we call sacred, but it's also just blatant racism. So if you're white and you rip off people and you participate in the slavery, it's excusable because it was complex times and we don't understand. And if you're black and you participated in slavery, it's terrible and you should not be, you know, allowed any complexity or anyway. So just name that. It's racism that made that film controversial.
Absolutely.
So just to say that out loud. Okay. And then the other thing is the complexity of this. So one, they dove into that. And what I said to people who refused to see this movie was you should go see the movie, because in the movie, they do deal with their complicity in the slave trade. And they do deal with what might it have been like to be part of that tribe and bought into that culture and have that disruption within you saying, like, there's something about what we're doing that's not right. Ooh. And then how can we hold what's good and amazing and true and also get rid of this thing that we bought into that's actually destroying our people instead of actually helping our people. So that theme is very complex. And I think one of the themes, and then the other way they do this is with the female thing. So you have this, like you said, the celebration of women warriors like this, which of course you and I were just like basically bursting out of our skin because we embodied.
We were losing it. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like they made this special group because outside of that group, women were suffering from gender violence and inferiority. And so you find the women that end up in that group are the women that can't submit to the patriarchal constructs that they're born into, this tribalism thing. And we follow the, you know, this one girl that just can't live with misogyny as an everyday practice. And so she doesn't fit in the society. And so she goes into this specialized group of warriors to be trained. So I also thought that's complex, because there's this tribe that celebrates the, you know, the women, and women are saving them. I mean, these are like highly trained elite, you know, women warriors that are an army that are undefeated so far in history. And, but at the same time, they're still treating their women, in the regular women, like crap. And I thought about that complexity, because that also is a complexity that we deal with, where women are often made specialists, or they're called exceptional, or we make room for people and celebrate women who are like, you know, top of the game. But then on every other level, we still practice this patriarchal misogynist practices of for women everywhere. And you're just like, what is that?
Yeah. And you know, and I'll add one more to that. The qualities that are celebrated in these women are the qualities that you would more align with masculine traits.
Right.
So the ones that you will revere, and I think about this moment where the Dahomeys, they're coming back into the village, and the village is lined up on both sides. They're celebrating their, like, once again, another victory, undefeated, like just a force to be reckoned with. And there's a sort of a village farmer male with some boys, and the boy's trying to sneak a picture. And he's like, you do not look at the Dahomey. Keep your eyes down. That reverence, that like awe almost of them. And I thought, wow. And then there are women that are in the palace, all adorned, discarded, not even like the king just doesn't have time for them. He's not even thinking of his own wife. He favors Maniska because he identifies his maleness in her. And so they'll celebrate what feels like alpha. It's interesting. And then those that are feminine, like all sort of feminine energy, you know, you do what I say, they're traumatized, they're raped, they're discarded, they're sold as trade, their lives are, I remember, I got to get her name, the daughter, if you can remember, goodness. Oh, got it here. Nawi is walking in, opening scene, to find out that she's been sold. and in a forced marriage. So it's interesting what is celebrated and what is not.
I think this is really crucial. Sorry to get real theological. I think this is so crucial to our understanding of God as well. And Cheryl, exactly what you say there. Well, these traditionally what we would call masculine traits, so strength, dominance, the ability to like outviolence your opponent. These are things that we want to celebrate. And we make those things masculine, or those things are masculine because we want to celebrate them. Like, I'm not sure the chicken or the egg there. But what I bring up all the time is the fruits of the spirit are not those things. The fruits of the spirit, the things that show that God's presence is alive, that the spirit is alive and breathing, are kindness and patience and gentleness and peace. And so we know what the spirit of God is like, but we're so desperate to celebrate violence that we make violence a masculine thing, and then we make violence a God thing, just ignoring what scripture tells us about the spirit of God. We make those things feminine and therefore not something to be celebrated. And I think there's something just all the time.
I love where you're going. Keep going, sir.
So I just think like the more and more, like if an experience is inherently female, we do not celebrate it. One of the things I was talking to my partner about the other day, and she was saying like, why is there no, I can't get down a rabbit hole here, but why is there no societal discourse at all about menopause? Like, this is something that half the population go through. No one talks about it. What are the tips? What are you supposed to do? Half our populations go through it, and yet no one can talk. Again, anything that's just like specifically feminine or female, we just don't talk about, we don't celebrate, and we refuse to make divine.
It's also old women. It's all, you know, you're aging, which is another whole have any room for you now, because now you can't, menopause is the symbol that you can't incubate any children for us anymore. So now you're completely,
you had one purpose and now you don't have it. Yeah,
that's right. And so that's, it's like next level, right? Because we can celebrate the onset of a period or something like that, because now you're fertile and you're useful to us. But menopause is that. And I think actually that's worth a whole episode. I think I'm going to do an episode on menopause, James.
Yo, can I, okay. I'm in for it.
That's great. Can I don't know how we got to menopause. Oh, here's one thing. Here's how we got there, I think, is, and you and I talked a lot about the Cheryl, so we'll give you a concise version here, folks. But basically the process, and again, this is the complicity, like the tension and complicated themes and nuanced levels of things going on in this film are just extravagant. Like it's really like she will not let anything be just what it is. It's all layered.
Yeah.
And one of the layers there that was so impactful for you and I remember in our conversation about it was just the warrior, the woman king, Viola Davis, her own revelation of how she had basically left her womanhood behind as weakness.
Yes.
So any displays of pain, the birth of her child, which she did in secret and then gave her child away, any kind of like feelings, basically, she had shut them down in order to be this warrior that was very male, you know, very separated from your emotions, very like strong, but like weak emotionally, but like not just shut down. Mm-hmm. And then most of the film, or a lot of the film, is this narrative about her, one, discovering this child.
Yeah.
And then that uncovering this whole part of her, this emotion, this pain, this all the things that she would have shut down because she would have considered it weakness. She has this moment where she goes, oh, wait a minute. This is actually strength.
Yeah. So good. Man, listen, let's stay here for a second. This idea of vulnerability as weakness is such a lie. Like, it's, and I think I'd love to just kind of correct course correction on that, because I used to feel that way. I absolutely lived that way. Vulnerability was weakness. Showing emotion was, Igozi and Naniska used to say, like, your tears, you have to dry up your tears. There are no more tears as a warrior. Your tears have to dry. You dry your eyes, like no more. And I think about one of the things that got me screaming when I was with Danielle. There was a battle of warriors, and Igozi is in the center with the other guy, and they have spears. Do you remember this? In their chests, and they're literally pushing towards each other, and those blades are going in deeper and deeper, and they're just getting more like frenzied, and it's just the screams are rising, and Igozi wins. And I think about how strong she looks in that moment. And just the scene after that, she talks about how her mother used to sell her, traffic her out. Mm-hmm. You could see the little girl broken. And that is the theme. These incredible warriors, all traumatized. Hey, Danielle, all broken.
What they've done, and I think this is what we've done in culture.
Stopped it.
Yeah, we've declared it sort of a male idea, but we've disassociated from emotions, which when you think about this in terms of the complexity of what the tribe is doing, they've done it as a tribe. They've disassociated their connection, their vulnerability to the people that they're selling. Because that's the only way that you can perpetuate injustice is you disassociate, you disconnect from the other, right? And then you even disconnect from yourself. So the levels of that disassociation, and then really what it is, that, or at least half of the movie is her reconnecting.
Yeah. It's
the reconnection to herself, the reconnection to the idea that maybe this isn't weakness, that actually maybe this is the kind of strength that would change a tribe to actually help a country instead of take from it, you know? So it's just a fascinating, like this idea of vulnerability as strength, but also just connecting again to our emotions and to one another as strength. And, you know, this goes back to the misogynistic practices of part of why women are considered weaker, you know, traditionally, is because they were connected. because they were in touch with their emotions, because they would cry when somebody was harmed, and men would be like, you got to shut that off in order to like go to war, you know, and which is why statistically, when women are involved in politics, by the way, this is just a throw out around the world to this day, there are way, way fewer wars, and peace lasts way longer when women are leading. And I think the reason why is because women are in touch with their emotions and in touch with other people, and they feel the weight of that. Like, they're not willing to suppress those things down in order to like, da, da, da. So this awakening of that main warrior, I thought was one of the most powerful moments in the film. Yeah. But I also think moments in culture, because I think we have bought into this idea that the only women we're willing to celebrate are women who look and act like men. And in order to do that, we've had to suppress who it is that we actually are and meant to be in the world. And instead of doing that, we should be celebrating the fact that women are good and should be good. And everyone should be good. Men should be learning from women about connection and vulnerability and strength and relationships.
I just want to jump on this because I want to stay here. Here's three incredible things that happened when Nanisca allowed herself to feel, right? One, she started to allow the feelings of motherhood to rise, which caused her to care for her people in a way that, as you said, she was blind to. And the more she was tapping in to these feelings of motherhood, the more she was convicted in this atrocity of slavery and the way they were going, and kept challenging the king on it. Two, as those feelings were arising, she started to allow herself to even forgive the girl who gave away this baby. She went into these places of healing, even dealt with forgiveness around, I believe, around that offender, the person that had horribly abused her. There was a whole piece there. The idea she talked about, like, she was running from a beast in a dream and realized that the beast is her, that she was running from her past, running from all the things that she was trying to forget, the pain. And then the beautiful thing here is that when she got in touch with her motherhood, she was willing to risk all that she had earned for blood, sweat, tears. I think about her body in this moment. She had scars to kind of show every battle. It was a thing of pride, you know, these proud wounds of battle. And she was willing to oppose the king in this moment that is so pivotal to me, because here is the woman king, the fiercest warrior of the land, being pushed in this place of, I am still your king. There's a male dominance moment. Do not leave this space. Do not go and rescue your daughter. And she's like, screw you, I'm going, right? It was that unbelievable.
But it's not even a screw you, I'm doing it, because like, it wasn't even a confrontation with power that way. It was a, I have to be true to myself.
Right.
Because I actually have discovered who I am.
Yes.
And it's that's that true empowerment where you no longer care now about what it costs you, or you no longer care. So she went and did that knowing that it would sacrifice her role as the future leader of the tribe. She knew that was what was at stake. And that's what he was threatening her with. Like, you will no longer be this person that is, you know, in highly elevated in our tribe. And she was willing then to sacrifice that for her daughter, because she had come in touch with who she really was and what she what she really loved and what mattered to her most. And that's what freedom is, right? It's not even like, true empowerment isn't even just a confrontation of a power or like a male hierarchy. True empowerment is doing what is true for you, doing what matters most, like doing the thing that actually is the thing you were designed to do. Like, maybe all of these warrior skills are for rescue instead of enslavement. Maybe all of these things that I have, all of these wounds that have happened to me, are for someone else's redemption and salvation instead of just my own, you know, elevation. Like, so I think there's something so profound even about that decision that she makes to come out of agreement with this oppression that keeps everybody believing that they have to. And I wonder about that in just like real life too. Like we all come into this agreement with the voice, whether it's in our own head or whether it's a king or whether it's a church leader or whether it's like a social construct that says you have to do this. You know, how many times have you heard like, I didn't have any choice. Yeah. And it's like, it's that is literally not having any choice is the definition of disempowerment. So I think that's so powerful because she was this very, like you couldn't get more powerful or revered or stronger than this woman. And then you see even at the end that she doesn't have any power. She, and I think she starts to see, oh, this isn't power. This is conformity to a construct. This isn't actual real power. And then she's like, actually, I'm going to be true to what it is that I feel like, you know, I'm supposed to do. And that's power. And then and in the happy ending, which again is not historically accurate, but in the happy ending, she's rewarded for that ultimately. But I think we are all rewarded for that ultimately in that we're free. We're free.
Man, and you know, the question that came up for me, which I'd love to ask all of us is like, it was a personal one, but maybe it hits you too. Cheryl, what are you willing to stand up against? What are you willing to put on the line for the liberation and freedom of others? Mm-hmm. You know, what are you willing to pay as a cost? Yeah. You know, because even in that moment, that diamond, that thing was being swung, this idea of woman king, never been done. It's almost thousands of years since the last one. It was this revered thing all on the line. You know, are we willing to walk away from position? Are we willing to walk away from promotion? Whatever the thing is, to do what is right, to liberate and bring freedom to others.
I mean, we could do this all day. We're gonna finish this up just with that, because I feel like that's a good question. And might I just make a little connection? It's pretty obvious, I think, but Jesus personifies this type of freedom. He refuses eliteness. He refuses, you know, in the washing of the disciples' feet passage, because he knew who he was and because he knew where he was going. He took off his rabbinical robe and he instead took on a servant posture and washed his disciples' feet. He lived a different way. He was a king like no other king. He refused that if you submit to our powers and principalities, then you can rule the world. And he's like, oh no, I'm never going to rule like that. Mm. And so there is this, you know, as we follow Jesus, I think what Jesus leads us to is an awakening of how we're participating in structures and systems that are destroying instead of giving life, how actually we can get back in touch with who it is. We can live vulnerably. We can live openly, transparently. We can live emotionally in beautiful connection with everything around us. And that ultimately to live our best selves is to live that way. The strongest people in the world are the ones who look the most like Jesus, who are willing to give up in order that others might live. And then in doing so, the scripture says, find themselves. You know, that's the mystery of the gospel, and it's worthy of pursuit. So Jesus was in this movie. I'm telling you that right now.
Let's go.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, see it. It's well worth watching. And then maybe use this as a bit of a guide for you to talk through some of the stuff that it brings up for you and what you might want to do with it. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for joining us, Cheryl.
Oh, such an honor.